Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Thursday, January 20th reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Colorado K-12 Public Schools, Enrollment Drops Again, by Jessica Seaman. COVID-19 masks, program rollout leads to confusion. State to give out free KN95s, but some agencies caught off guard, by Jake Shapiro. Washington, after a year in office, Biden appeals to voters for patience, by Zeke Miller and Josh Bowack. Washington, inability to alter filibuster dooms Dems voting bill, by Lisa Mascaro. Colorado K-12 Public Schools, Enrollment Drops Again, by Jessica Seaman, The Denver Post. Enrollment in Colorado's K-12 schools has yet to rebound to pre-pandemic levels, as 1,174 fewer students enrolled last fall compared with the previous year, according to a report released Wednesday by the State Department of Education. The decline in enrollment is small, less than 1%, compared with the first year of the public health crisis, but it places schools at risk of losing money and comes on the heels of the state's public schools losing more than 20,000 students during the 2020-21 school year. It can be logistically challenging for districts that are staffed for higher numbers of students, said Kate Bartlett, Executive Director of School District Operations for the state's Education Department. We reach a point of, how do we manage this? There were 855,482 students enrolled in K-12 schools in October, which is down slightly from 856,656 students the previous year. By comparison, in fall 2019, the state had 878,537 K-12 students, according to the enrollment data. There are multiple reasons for the decline, including the state's declining birth rate, families moving out of state, and the fact that not all of the students who left last year for homeschooling have returned, Bartlett said. Students who are enrolled in online classes via their public school because of the pandemic are still counted in the district's enrollment numbers. Colorado is not the only state seeing public school enrollment declining, and even the nation's largest districts are being hit, including in New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago, according to a recent report by NPR. Colorado's largest school district, Denver Public Schools, saw enrollment in preschool through 12th grade decline by 172 people to 88,889 students, according to the enrollment data. And Jeffco Public Schools saw one of the largest declines in enrollment, losing 1,615 students this year, for a total of 78,473 students in preschool through grade 12. Overall, 115 of the state's 178 school districts, such as School District 27J in Adams County and Harrison 2 School District in El Paso County, saw enrollment increases this year. Colorado saw 4,478 more children, a 17% increase, attending preschool last fall than in 2020. There were 30,894 preschoolers in October, according to the data. COVID-19 masks. Program rollout leads to confusion. State to give out free KN95s, but some agencies caught off guard. By Jake Shapiro, The Denver Post. Colorado plans to distribute free KN95 and surgical-grade masks through public libraries, fire stations, and other community locations beginning this week. But the program's rollout led to confusion Wednesday, as some agencies, including the Denver Public Library, warned the public they had no masks to offer. Governor Jared Polis's office announced Tuesday afternoon the high-grade masks would be handed out at locations that also include recreation centers, VFWs, YMCAs, and high-traffic community centers as part of the state's ongoing effort to stop the spread of COVID-19. Mask distribution sites are listed at covid19.colorado.gov/freemasks. We are on a mission to help Coloradans keep themselves safe, and free medical-grade masks are far more effective in preventing infection than cloth masks, Polis said in a news release. By making free medical-grade masks available at libraries across our state and soon for home delivery, we are giving Coloradans a powerful tool to avoid infection. But the public announcement of the program by the governor's office appeared to catch some off guard. Several Front Range public library systems, including Denver, Jefferson County, and Pueblo, took to social media Tuesday evening to tell their patrons that, despite appearing on the state's list of providers, they did not have KN95 masks to give out. The Denver Public Library later deleted its social media posts on the subject. Fire agencies, including the Greeley Fire Department, Adams County Fire, and the Pueblo Fire Department, also posted on social media that, despite the governor's announcement that fire stations would be among the sites participating, they were not distributing the KN95 masks. By late morning Wednesday, the state website's page on the free mask program was edited to remove the reference to the face coverings being available at fire stations, recreation centers, VFWs, and YMCAs. At this time, only the following libraries are offering masks, the page now says. More locations to follow. Erica Martinez, communications director for the Denver Public Library, said the facility deleted its social media posts to avoid adding any additional confusion to our community. She encouraged people to seek out other locations that are scheduled to distribute the masks. In Denver, the KN95s will be available at the Colorado State Services Building, 1525 Sherman Street, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. beginning Thursday. We don't believe it's in the best interest of our community to discuss the behind-the-scenes activities of the rollout, Martinez wrote in an email Wednesday morning. The Denver Library did order KN95 masks from the state for workers' use, she said, but it does not have any for public distribution. We are working with the state and our team to iron out the operational needs and what it would take for our organization to distribute, she said. Later Wednesday, the state removed the Denver Public Library from its list of mass pickup locations, adding a note that said, Denver Public Libraries are unable to distribute masks to the public at this time. The city and county of Denver is working to identify recreation centers that will have masks for public distribution. Nick Potter, director of community relations for the Pueblo Library District, said the announcement wasn't a surprise, but rather a matter of focusing the headline and skipping the details. He said the Pueblo Library received 8,000 masks around 7 a.m. Wednesday. Distribution is scheduled to begin Friday. The Jeffco Library System received 2,500 KN95 masks to be distributed through its 10 branch locations, Kim McGrigg, the library's communications director, said. We anticipate that they will be distributed very quickly and are in the process of ordering more. In Boulder County, libraries in Louisville and Lyons confirmed they had received masks from the state and were prepared to begin distributing them. Given Boulder County's long-running mask mandate, we've provided disposable surgical masks at our entrance for a long time, but we're thankful for an opportunity to provide the additional protection of a KN95 to our visitors, Lyons Community Library Director Kara Bauman said. The Colorado State Joint Information Center reported 82,000 KN95 masks and 226,000 surgical masks were delivered to distribution points Tuesday. And the governor's office said hundreds of thousands more were being shipped Wednesday. Officials did not respond when asked about how much the masks cost and how many the state ultimately intends to buy. They did say, however, that the Federal Emergency Management Agency will reimburse the costs of the masks, although the state is paying for transportation and shipping. By Wednesday evening, officials said every location on Colorado's distribution list had received masks, and that the state had received requests from 63 more locations, 57 libraries, and 6 fire departments to participate in the wake of Tuesday's announcement. Those locations will be added to the list once they receive their masks. The locations who were originally listed filled out the form agreeing to be a redistribution hub for KN95 masks, and we are in discussions with them to be even more clear about promoting the free medical grade masks through their own communication channels. Connor Cahill, the governor's press secretary, said in a statement when asked whether locations such as the Denver Public Library had been given advance notice of Tuesday's announcement. State officials also had been distributing higher quality masks at schools. According to the state, they're offering masks to provide high quality personal protective equipment to Coloradans who might be especially at risk during the pandemic and future public health emergencies. The state recommends people upgrade from cloth masks to medical grade masks like N95, KN95, or surgical masks. Washington. After a year in office, Biden appeals to voters for patience. By Zeke Miller and Josh Bowack, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. President Joe Biden acknowledged Wednesday that the pandemic has left Americans exhausted and demoralized, but insisted at a news conference marking his first year in office that he has outperformed expectations in dealing with it. Facing sagging poll numbers and a stalled legislative agenda, Biden conceded he will have to pare back his Build Back Better recovery package and instead settle for big chunks of his signature economic plan. He promised to further attack inflation and the pandemic and blamed Republicans for uniting in opposition to his proposals rather than offering ideas of their own. This is a perilous time for Biden. The nation is gripped by a disruptive new surge of virus cases, and inflation is at a level not seen in a generation. Democrats are bracing for a potential midterm rout if he can't turn things around. Biden insisted that voters will come to embrace a more positive view of his tenure and of his beleaguered party in time. His appeal to voters for patience came with a pledge to spend more time outside Washington to make the case to them directly. Biden also addressed the brewing crisis on the Ukrainian border, where Russia has massed 100,000 troops and raised concerns that Moscow is ready to launch a further invasion. The president said his guess is Russia may move further, but he believes President Vladimir Putin doesn't want war. He declared Russia would pay a dear price if Putin launches a military incursion. He has to do something, Biden said of Putin. He's trying to find his place in the world between China and the West. Biden suggested a minor incursion might elicit a lesser response than a full-scale invasion of the country, a comment that drew immediate condemnation from some corners. President Biden basically gave Putin a green light to invade Ukraine by yammering about the supposed insignificance of a minor incursion, said Republican Senator Ben Sasse. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki indicated in a subsequent statement that that wasn't necessarily about tanks and troops. President Biden also knows from long experience that the Russians have an extensive playbook of aggression short of military action, including cyber attacks and paramilitary tactics. And he affirmed today that those acts of Russian aggression will be met with a decisive, reciprocal, and united response, she said. Biden held forth for an hour and 50 minutes in the East Room of the White House, appearing to relish the opportunity to parry questions from two dozen journalists with doses of wit and a few flashes of anger. At several points, he looked at his watch, smiled, and kept calling on reporters. He fielded questions about inflation, nuclear talks with Iran, voting rights, political division, Vice President Kamala Harris's place on the 2024 ticket, trade with China, and the competency of government. Those questions showed the multitude of challenges confronting the president, each of them as much a risk as an opportunity to prove himself. The president began by reeling off early progress in fighting the virus and showcasing quick passage of an ambitious bipartisan roads and bridges infrastructure deal. But his economic, voting rights, police reform, and immigration agenda have been thwarted in a barely Democratic-controlled Senate, while inflation has emerged as an economic threat to the nation and a political risk for Biden. Despite his faltering approval numbers, Biden claimed to have probably outperformed what anybody thought would happen in a country still coping with the coronavirus. After almost 2 years of physical, emotional, and psychological impact of this pandemic, for many of us, it's been too much to bear, Biden said. Some people may call what's happening now the new normal, he added, his voice rising. I call it a job not yet finished. It will get better. On his nearly $2 trillion economic agenda that West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin has blocked from moving forward, Biden said he will pass the parts of the package that can net sufficient votes. This likely means not extending the expanded child tax credit or providing financial support to community colleges, Biden said. I think we can break the package up, get as much as we can now, come back and fight for the rest, he said, later adding that he would apply the same strategy to his voting reform agenda. The social spending bill once was viewed as a catch-all home for various progressive priorities. But now, Democrats are sensing a need to deliver a solid accomplishment to voters in the midterm year and are beginning to come to terms with a slimmed-down package that can overcome Manchin's reticence. The White House and congressional Democratic leaders are expected to refocus their attention on it beginning next week, after the collapse of the Democrats' push on voting rights legislation. Talks to craft a new bill that meets Manchin's demands and can garner the virtually unanimous Democratic support needed to pass Congress will likely take weeks. The Democrats' goal is to have a package, or be on the cusp of one, that Biden can highlight in his March 1st State of the Union address. If Biden seemed to have one set of regrets so far, it was his inability because of the coronavirus to connect with more Americans outside the Capitol. He noted that this challenge was most acutely felt by Black voters who wanted him to push more aggressively on expanding access to voting. I don't get a chance to look people in the eye because of both COVID and things that are happening in Washington, he said. Speaking as Democrats were mounting a doomed effort to change Senate rules to pass the voting measure, Biden said he still hoped that it would pass in some form and wasn't prepared to discuss possible executive actions on the issue. The vote spotlighted the constraints on Biden's influence barely a week after he delivered an impassioned speech in Atlanta, suggesting opponents of the measures were taking an historical stance alongside segregationists and exhorting senators to action. Still, he said he understood that civil rights groups were anxious and frustrated about the lack of action, particularly Black voters who questioned why he didn't press the issue harder and earlier. There are at least 19 Republican-backed laws in states that make it harder to vote, and the January 6th insurrection supporters are filling local election posts and running for office. Washington. Inability to alter filibuster Dooms Dems voting bill by Lisa Mascaro, The Associated Press. Byline, Washington. Voting legislation that Democrats and civil rights leaders say is vital to protecting a democracy collapsed Wednesday when two senators refused to join their own party in changing Senate rules to overcome a Republican filibuster after a raw emotional debate. The outcome was a stinging defeat for President Joe Biden and his party, coming at the tumultuous close to his first year in office. Despite a day of piercing debate and speeches that often carried echoes of an earlier era when the Senate filibuster was deployed by opponents of civil rights legislation, Democrats could not persuade holdout Senators Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia to change the Senate procedures on this one bill and allow a simple majority to advance it. "This is a moral moment," said Senator Raphael Warnock, Democrat of Georgia. "Voting rights advocates are warning that Republican-led states nationwide are passing laws making it more difficult for Black Americans and others to vote by consolidating polling locations, requiring certain types of identification, and ordering other changes." Vice President Kamala Harris presided, able to break a tie in the 50-50 Senate if needed, but she left before the final roll call. The rules change was rejected on a 52-48 vote, with Manchin and Sinema joining the Republicans in opposition. The nighttime voting brought an end, for now, to legislation that has been a top Democratic priority since the party swept control of Congress and the White House. "I haven't given up," Biden said at a White House news conference. The Democrats' bill, the Freedom to Vote John R. Lewis Act, would make Election Day a national holiday, ensure access to early voting and mail-in ballots, which had become especially popular during the pandemic, and enable the Justice Department to intervene in states with a history of voter interference, among other changes. It passed the House. Manchin and Sinema say they support the legislation, but Democrats fell far short of the 60 votes needed to advance the bill over the Republican filibuster. The measure failed 51-49 on a largely party line vote. Instead, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer put forward a more specific rules change for a talking filibuster on this one bill. It would have required senators to stand at their desks and exhaust the debate before holding a simple majority vote, rather than the current practice that simply allows senators to privately signal their objections. But that too failed because Manchin and Sinema said they were unwilling to change the rules on a party line vote by Democrats alone. Capitol breach. Supreme Court allows committee to get Trump documents, by Mark Sherman, the Associated Press, byline Washington. In a rebuff to former President Donald Trump, the Supreme Court is allowing the release of presidential documents sought by the Congressional Committee investigating the January 6 insurrection. The justices on Wednesday rejected a bid by Trump to withhold the documents from the committee until the issue is finally resolved by the courts. Trump's lawyers had hoped to prolong the court fight and keep the documents on hold. After the high court's action, there is no legal impediment to turning over the documents, which are held by the National Archives and Records Administration. They include presidential diaries, visitor logs, speech drafts, and handwritten notes dealing with January 6th from the files of former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. The House committee agreed to defer its attempt to get some documents at the request of the Biden White House. The current administration was concerned that releasing all of the Trump administration documents sought by the committee could compromise national security and executive privilege. Alone among the justices, Clarence Thomas said he would have granted Trump's request to keep the documents on hold. Trump's attorneys had asked the high court to reverse rulings by the federal appeals court in Washington and block the release of the records, even after President Joe Biden waived executive privilege over them. In an unsigned opinion, the court acknowledged there are serious and substantial concerns over which a former president can win a court order to prevent disclosure of certain records from his time in office in a situation like this one. But the court noted that the appeals court determined that Trump's assertion of privilege over the documents would fail under any circumstances, even if he were the incumbent. Related. New York Attorney General says Trump's company misled banks, tax officials. The New York Attorney General says her investigators have uncovered evidence that former President Donald Trump's company used fraudulent or misleading valuations of its golf clubs, skyscrapers, and other property to get loans and tax benefits. In a court filing late Tuesday, lawyers for Attorney General Letitia James told a judge they have not decided whether to bring a lawsuit in connection with the allegations, but that investigators should be allowed to question Trump and his two eldest children under oath as part of the civil probe. The Trump Organization issued a statement Wednesday calling the investigation baseless and politically motivated. Justices address report about mass conflicts, byline Washington. In an unusual joint statement Wednesday, Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch sought to rebut reports that Gorsuch's refusal to wear a mask at Supreme Court arguments has created tensions between them. Reporting that Justice Sotomayor asked Justice Gorsuch to wear a mask surprised us, the statement said. It is false. While we may sometimes disagree about the law, we are warm colleagues and friends. A few hours later, Chief Justice John Roberts issued his own statement. I did not request Justice Gorsuch or any other justice to wear a mask on the bench, he said. Since the justices returned this month from their holiday break, all of them started to wear masks in the courtroom, except Gorsuch. At the same time, Sotomayor, who has diabetes and had been the only member of the court to wear a mask since the justices returned to the bench in October, started to participate in arguments remotely from her chambers. Sotomayor sits next to Gorsuch on the bench. The justices' statements seemed primarily to be directed at a report by Nina Totenberg of NPR on Tuesday attributed to court sources. In it, Totenberg said Sotomayor did not feel safe in close proximity to people who were unmasked. Chief Justice John Roberts, understanding that, in some form asked the other justices to mask up, the report said. The justices' statements did not say whether Sotomayor's absence from the courtroom was a consequence of Gorsuch's decision not to wear a mask. But Roberts rejected the assertion that he had asked his colleagues to wear masks on the bench. An NPR spokesperson said that it stands behind Nina Totenberg's reporting. All of the justices are fully vaccinated and have received a booster shot, a court spokesperson has said. This is from the New York Times Company. Biden to give away 400 million N95 masks starting next week. Byline, Washington. The Biden administration will begin making 400 million N95 masks available for free to U.S. residents starting next week. Now that federal officials are emphasizing their better protection against the Omicron variant of COVID-19 over cloth face coverings. The White House announced Wednesday that the masks will come from the government's strategic national stockpile, which has more than 750 million of the highly protective masks on hand. The masks will be available for pickup at pharmacies and community health centers across the country. They will begin shipping this week for distribution starting late next week, the White House said. This will be the largest distribution of free masks by the federal government to the public since the pandemic began. This is from the Associated Press. Volcanic eruption. First aid flights leave for Tonga. By Nick Perry, the Associated Press. The first flights carrying fresh water and other aid to Tonga were able to leave Thursday after the Pacific nation's main airport runway was cleared of ash left by a huge volcanic eruption. A C-130 Hercules military transport plane left New Zealand carrying water containers, kits for temporary shelters, generators, hygiene supplies, and communications equipment. New Zealand's Foreign Minister Nania Mahuta said. Australia also sent a C-17 Globemaster transport plane with another to follow, carrying humanitarian supplies. The flights were all due to arrive in Tonga on Thursday afternoon. The deliveries will be done with no contact because Tonga is desperate to make sure foreigners don't bring in the coronavirus. It has not had any outbreaks of COVID-19 and has reported just a single case since the pandemic began. The aircraft is expected to be on the ground for up to 90 minutes before returning to New Zealand, Defense Minister Pini Henare said. Japan also said it would send emergency relief, including drinking water and equipment for clearing volcanic ash. Two Hercules aircraft and a transport vessel carrying two CH-47 Chinook helicopters would leave possibly Thursday, the defense ministry said. Japanese Defense Minister Nobuo Kishi told reporters that his ministry will do everything we can for the disaster-hit people of Tonga. UN humanitarian officials report that about 84,000 people, more than 80% of Tonga's population, have been impacted by the volcano's eruption. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric said, pointing to 3 deaths, injuries, loss of homes, and polluted water. Communications with Tonga remained limited after Saturday's eruption, and tsunami appeared to have broken the single fiber optic cable that connects Tonga to the rest of the world. That means most people haven't been able to use the internet or make phone calls abroad, although some local phone networks are working. A Navy patrol ship from New Zealand is also expected to arrive later Thursday. It is carrying hydrographic equipment and divers and has a helicopter to assist with delivering supplies. Officials said the ship's first task would be to check shipping channels and the structural integrity of the wharf in the capital, Nuku'olafa, after the eruption and tsunami. Another New Zealand Navy ship carrying 66,000 gallons of water is on its way. The ship can also produce tens of thousands of gallons of fresh water each day using desalination equipment. 3 of Tonga's smaller islands suffered serious damage from tsunami waves, officials and the Red Cross said. The UN's Dujarric said all houses have apparently been destroyed on the island of Mango, and only 2 houses remain on Fonoifua Island, with extensive damage reported on Nomuka. He said evacuations are underway for people from the islands. According to Tongan census figures, Mango is home to 36 people, Fonoifua is home to 69 people, and Nomuka to 239. The majority of Tongans live on the main island of Tongatapu, where about 50 homes were destroyed. In briefs, 2 Marines killed, 17 injured in 7-ton vehicle rollover. 2 Marines were killed and 17 were injured Wednesday when their 7-ton military vehicle rolled over while going too fast around a turn near Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, authorities said. The driver of the vehicle was trying to make a right turn onto US 17 from North Carolina 210 in Onslow County when it rolled into the median just after 1 p.m., according to the Highway Patrol. 17 Marines who were in the back of the vehicle were ejected, the Highway Patrol said. Another military vehicle that was behind the tactical vehicle was unable to stop and struck one of the ejected Marines, the Highway Patrol said. 2 Marines were dead at the scene, and 2 who were critically injured were taken to a hospital in Wilmington. The 15 other Marines who were injured were taken to Naval Medical Center Camp Lejeune, where they were listed as in stable condition. UK's Johnson defies calls to quit, byline London. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson defied calls to resign in a feisty performance Wednesday in Parliament, but it may be too little to prevent a push by his Conservative Party's lawmakers to oust him over a series of lockdown-flouting government parties. Pressure on the Prime Minister grew as one Conservative lawmaker defected to the opposition Labour Party and a former Conservative cabinet minister told him, in the name of God, go. Ghislaine Maxwell's bid for a new trial faces a major hurdle, byline New York. Revelations in the media that 2 jurors disclosed personal histories of childhood sexual abuse to their fellow jurors during deliberations at Ghislaine Maxwell's sex trafficking trial have clouded the verdict and led to a flurry of new court filings focused on jury impartiality. In trying to assess the effect of the jury room disclosures, the judge, Allison J. Nathan of U.S. District Court, is likely to be blocked by one of the legal system's most stringent and time-honored rules. She cannot ask the jurors what happened during their deliberations, and the jurors are not allowed to tell her. Mimu, who found fame in The Time Machine, dies at 80, byline New York. Yvette Mimieux, who found stardom in the early 1960s portraying delicate, fragile women in The Time Machine, Where the Boys Are, and other films, died on Monday night at her home in Los Angeles. She was 80. Mimieux was the starlet of the moment in 1960, playing opposite Rod Taylor in The Time Machine, based on H.G. Wells' classic 1895 novel. Taylor, as the time-traveling gentleman scientist from 1890s London, encounters Mimu in the year A.D. 800,000 as Weena, one of the Eloi, a gentle blonde people so naive they don't realize they are being bred as food for the predatory Morlocks. In 1960, she appeared in Where the Boys Are, the spring break movie about college students in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in the age of the sexual double standard. Mimu's character makes a serious and socially fatal mistake. She has too much to drink, is molested, and is last seen walking, dazed, and confused down a highway median. Pioneering fashion journalist Andre Leon Talley dies at 73, Byline, New York. Andre Leon Talley, a towering and highly visible figure of the fashion world who made history as a rare black editor in an overwhelmingly white industry, has died. He was 73. The influential former creative director and editor-at-large of Vogue magazine, dressed in sweeping capes or colorful caftans. Talley was a regular in the front row of fashion shows for decades, or atop the famous steps at the Met Gala. At 6'6", he cut an imposing and unforgettable figure. A Vogue staffer called him the Pharaoh of Fabulosity, the magazine wrote. These were from Denver Post Wire Services. Marshall Fire, Omicron, Behind Move. Coloradans Get New Chance to Sign Up for Health Insurance, by Markian Haraluk, Kaiser Health News. The Marshall Fire displaced thousands of Coloradans just as the Omicron surge began sweeping through the state. So health insurance was likely not on many people's minds when the regular enrollment period for the state's health insurance marketplace ended January 15th. But now, because of those twin emergencies, everyone in Colorado will get another chance to sign up. State officials on Wednesday launched a special marketplace enrollment period through March 16th, open to all uninsured Coloradans, regardless of whether they've been directly affected by the Marshall Fire or the COVID surge. The Marshall Fire started on December 30th, just 2 weeks before the deadline to sign up for a 2022 plan. The fires destroyed more than 1,000 houses and businesses, quickly becoming the state's most destructive fire by the number of structures lost. It's such a disruption to people's lives, Colorado Insurance Commissioner Michael Conway said. It's not just the people who lost their homes. It's across the board, affecting the entire community. Meanwhile, the emergence of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus caused COVID cases to spike to record levels in January, stressing hospitals and health systems. These folks are just trying to put their lives back together, said Kevin Patterson, CEO of Connect for Health Colorado, the state's health insurance marketplace created under the Affordable Care Act. So giving them some additional time seemed like a reasonable and thoughtful thing to consider. In addition to providing immediate relief to Coloradans in a crisis, the move underscores how much industry attitudes toward the Affordable Care Act have changed. Insurance companies were initially skeptical about the financial risks and worried that consumers would game the system. But the insurers have largely embraced the exchanges and are working to sign up as many people as possible. After experiencing few problems during the special enrollment period held last year because of COVID, health plans have agreed to the removal of safeguards, such as a limited window of time to sign up for the coverage that regulators once required. Amid the recent COVID-19 surge and tragic wildfires, it is important that people in Colorado have the opportunity to obtain health care coverage, Patrick Gordon, CEO of the Rocky Mountain Health Plans, said in an email. Special enrollment periods have been used in California because of wildfires, in Maine when strong winds knocked down power lines, and in Gulf states hit by Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. Such periods have often been limited in scope and sometimes required people to provide proof they have been affected. Meanwhile, Colorado state officials opted to make signing up for coverage as easy as possible and are not requiring consumers to demonstrate they qualify. It didn't seem like something that was necessary, especially when we look at our experience over the last year, Conway said. The vast majority of the year was effectively a special enrollment period, and there wasn't that much disruption in the market. Insurance analyst Charles Gaba said there are three primary reasons for limiting health plan signups to an open enrollment period. The first is that deadlines spur people to sign up. Each year, enrollment numbers spike in the final days of the sign-up period. Second, insurance companies need time to analyze their revenue and costs to set premiums for the following year. That process, Gaba said, typically begins in March. And third, and most importantly, insurance companies initially lobbied for a limited open enrollment period to keep people from waiting until they are sick to buy insurance. That changed during the pandemic. Colorado and most other states that run their own exchanges held special enrollment periods in 2020 and 2021 because of COVID. When the Trump administration declined to do the same for the federal exchange, health insurance trade groups urged it to reconsider. The incoming Biden administration agreed and extended the enrollment period through August 2021, and more than 2.8 million additional Americans signed up for the coverage. Conway said no evidence exists that consumers waited until they were sick to buy coverage last year. With so many consumers eligible for no-cost or low-cost plans because of more generous subsidies, there is little reason for them not to sign up immediately. As health policy folks, sometimes we get into our heads and we see monsters under the bed that simply are not there because of the complexity of the system, Conway said. Health plans in Colorado were largely supportive of the move. John Roble, president of Cigna's Mountain States Market, said the company is allowing early prescription refills and is working with local hospitals to transfer patients to help alleviate crowding at overwhelmed facilities. Past special enrollment periods largely attracted a healthier population than standard open enrollment periods. Those with chronic health conditions usually enroll early in the standard open enrollment period. They are first out of the gate, said Louise Norris, who operates a Colorado health insurance brokerage with her husband. They're ready to sign up November 1st. States that run their own exchanges often extend the deadline for signing up another week or two, but it's not clear whether any other state will follow Colorado's example and provide a two-month or longer window in response to the Omicron surge. Without the fires, I'm not sure that they would be thinking about it, Conway said. Kaiser Health News is a national health policy news service. It is an editorially independent program of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, which is not affiliated with Kaiser Permanente. Bone found where missing woman seen during fire. Investigators have recovered small bone fragments at the Superior property where the final person still missing in the Marshall Fire was last seen, Boulder County Sheriff's officials announced Wednesday morning. The sheriff's and coroner's offices have been searching a property in the 1500 block of South 76th Street for the remains of Edna Nadine Turnbull. Officials say the 91-year-old woman had been notified to evacuate during the December 30th wildfire, but went back into the house to rescue her dogs. Scientific testing is underway to determine whether the collected bone fragments are human, the sheriff's office said. These tests can take weeks to months. Turnbull has been missing since the fire. We remain committed to seeking answers and closure for the Turnbull family, the sheriff's office said in a news release. The costly fire that damaged or destroyed 1,270 homes and businesses has one confirmed fatality. Robert Sharp, 69, was identified earlier this month. His remains were found at his home in the 5900 block of Marshall Road. This was from Jake Shapiro, the Denver Post. Mountain lion visits Loveland Fire Station. Members of the Loveland Fire Rescue Authority and local wildlife experts had an unusual experience Monday morning as a mountain lion found its way to LFRA Station 7 west of Loveland, but they safely coaxed the animal back into the wilderness. Lieutenant Dustin Waldorf said that when his crew said they saw the mountain lion, at first he didn't believe them. He said that it walked in front of the station doors, then made its way to the gated dumpster area of the building. It stayed there for most of the encounter. Waldorf said after he called the Colorado Parks and Wildlife, a wildlife officer was sent down from Estes Park to help. Waldorf said that luckily, Big Thompson Elementary School, next to the station, was empty because it was Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Waldorf said the officer used a police stun device to stun the animal, and it ran away. This is from the Reporter Herald. Lakewood, man sentenced to life in prison for strangulation of girlfriend, by Kiernan Nicholson, The Denver Post. A Lakewood man has been sentenced to life in prison for the strangulation death of his girlfriend in her Lakewood home. Carl Aaron Beamish, 52, was sentenced Friday after pleading guilty to first-degree murder in the death of 45-year-old Hillary Engel, according to the Jefferson County District Attorney's Office. We are thankful for the prosecution's work on this case, and that even though we continue to grieve the loss of Hillary, we believe this result was the best available outcome, Engel's family said in a statement, part of the district attorney's news release. Engel, a nurse, is survived by an 8-year-old son, among family and friends. On December 29, 2020, Engel was reported missing by her father after she was last seen dropping her son off at daycare the previous morning, the release said. Her body was found inside her Green Mountain area home, hidden under a bed. After the killing, Beamish drove to Trinidad in Engel's car. He was arrested at a hotel after using her ATM card to get money. In his plea, Beamish admitted to strangling Engel, prosecutors said. This is not a case that my office felt appropriate to negotiate, Amanda Lessman, senior deputy district attorney, told the court, according to the release. A plea to murder one and its coinciding life sentence is appropriate. There is no possibility of parole as part of the sentence. Xcel Energy. Speakers urge Colorado regulators to turn down $182 million rate hike, by Judith Kohler, The Denver Post. Speakers urged the Colorado Public Utilities Commission at a Wednesday hearing to reject a $182 million rate increase sought by Xcel Energy, saying will put a burden on low-income customers, even as the utility continues to make big profits in the state. Xcel Energy Colorado, the state's largest electric utility, originally asked for a $343 million increase last summer. A proposed settlement with a number of interest groups and state agencies in December, nearly half of the total. Under the proposed settlement, an average residential customer's monthly electric bill would rise by about $5.24, or 6.44%. Small businesses would see their monthly bills increase by about $6.64, or 6.24% on average. If approved, the new rates would take effect April 1st. Xcel Energy officials have said the money will pay for improvements and updates previously approved by the PUC. In a 2021 interview, Xcel Energy Colorado President Alice Jackson said the utility's rates in Colorado are 35% below the national average. But the increase would be one of the largest for Xcel Energy, said Leslie Klustrom with Clean Energy Action and a longtime participant in PUC issues. She said during a public hearing that federal filings show the Minneapolis-based utility reported $588 million in after-tax net income in the state in 2020. Regulators approved $41.5 million rate increase for Xcel Energy at the end of 2019. Glustrom said the PUC's own records and public testimony provide everything it needs to send a strong message that it's not okay to keep using Colorado as a cash cow and to keep charging more while the price of renewable energy keeps dropping. Although Xcel Energy is moving toward using more renewable energy, it still gets more than 50% of its electricity from fossil fuels. Xcel Energy spokeswoman Michelle Aguayo said that in 2020, 26% of the utility's power came from coal, 37% from natural gas, 31% from wind, 5% from solar, and 1% from other carbon-free sources. The company was the first electric utility in the country to set a goal of eventually being carbon-free. It has pledged to cut its greenhouse gas emissions 85% by 2030. Bill Levis, a consultant for AARP Colorado, noted that Xcel Energy has testified that use by its commercial and industrial customers is decreasing compared to its residential customers. A rate increase, along with surcharges approved by the legislature to finance the state's transition to renewable energy, will disproportionately burden low-income residential customers and retirees on fixed incomes, Levis said in a written testimony on the proposed rate increase. Parties in the negotiations over the rate increase that agreed to the settlement or didn't object include the PUC staff, the Colorado Office of the Utility Consumer Advocate, Energy Outreach Colorado, the Sierra Club, and Colorado Energy Customers. Electric Resource Plan. Tri-State aims to cut rates and emissions, by Judith Kohler, the Denver Post. Tri-State Generation and Transmission Association, a wholesale power provider serving rural utilities in Colorado and three other states, has reached a settlement with several parties on a plan aimed at cutting costs for ratepayers and setting ambitious goals for reducing carbon emissions. The Colorado Public Utilities Commission will consider Tri-State's electric resource plan. The plan charts the sources the Westminster-based power provider will use to generate electricity for its 42-member electric cooperatives through 2026. The proposal drew praise from environmental groups that previously have criticized Tri-State for relying too much on coal. It's exciting when utilities and clean air advocates find themselves on the same page about what needs to happen to reduce pollution and save customers money, Sarah Sneed with the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign in Colorado said in a statement. About 2 years ago, Tri-State announced what it called its Responsible Energy Plan, which included significantly boosting renewable energy sources, closing its coal plants, and slashing greenhouse gas emissions from its operations. The plan that will go to state regulators commits Tri-State to reducing emissions from its electricity sales in Colorado by 80% in 2030, based on 2005 levels. In the near term, the company says it will cut emissions by 26% in 2025, 36% in 2026, and 46% in 2027. A 2019 state law requires utilities to map out how to cut carbon dioxide emissions associated with the power it sells by 80% from 2005 levels by 2030 and 100% by 2050. Tri-State has come a long way. This important agreement marks the first time Tri-State is committing to near-term enforceable reductions in climate-changing greenhouse gas pollution, said John Golden Dubois, president of Western Resource Advocates, a Boulder-based conservation group. As part of its shift to more renewable energy, Tri-State has closed coal plants in Colorado and New Mexico, plans to retire more, and is adding 8 wind and solar projects to its system, enough renewable energy to power 850,000 homes. Tri-State expects that 70% of the power for Colorado members will come from renewable energy sources by 2030. While acknowledging Tri-State's progress, Eric Frankowski, executive director of the Western Clean Energy Campaign, said the company hasn't committed to retiring its stakes in coal-fired plants in Arizona and Wyoming. The plants are expensive to run, so Tri-State should be looking at ways to remove them as resources to save their member co-ops money, Frankowski said in an email. Two of Tri-State's member electric associations that left the cooperative complained about the utility's rates and what they said was a failure to move more quickly toward renewable energy. The Delta Montrose Electric Association in Montrose left in 2020, and the Kit Carson Electric Cooperative in Taos left in 2016. Tri-State's members had an opportunity to make their voices heard during the development of the utility's new resource plan. Jeff Wadsworth, president and CEO for Poudre Valley Rural Electric Association in Fort Collins, said in a statement, "We are encouraged by the plan's environmental aspects as well as its recognition of the importance of reliability and affordability to our members," Wadsworth said. Tri-State said it will complete a 4% wholesale rate reduction for its members in March. The first 2% of the reduction was implemented in 2021. In addition, the company said it will start exploring ways to assist communities in northwest Colorado as the area prepares for the closure of a coal plant in Craig by 2030. Colorado Unemployment Relief. Businesses press state for $600 million. By Megan Ululani-Boyanton, The Denver Post. Colorado businesses are pushing state lawmakers to alleviate pressure on their bottom lines by putting at least $600 million toward a trust fund benefiting unemployed workers. The call to action came Tuesday as 75 business owners, trade associations, and other entities urged legislators to back Governor Jared Polis's budget proposal for fiscal 2023, which would allocate that money to Colorado's Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. The fund is meant to compensate laborers for unemployment claims, but it ran out of money in August 2020 after the jump in job losses and benefit payments during the pandemic, the Colorado Department of Labor and Employment reported. Employers now fear the burden to replenish the state trust fund will deliver another financial blow as higher premium payments loom in the coming years. Without any financial relief, that all falls on the shoulders of employers to have to pay back through no fault of their own, said Lauren Furman, president and CEO of the Colorado Chamber of Commerce, who called it a huge concern. Her association led the effort to send Tuesday's letter to lawmakers, which highlighted the nationwide labor shortage, supply chain issues, inflation, and COVID-related shutdowns as other issues also confronting business owners. Employers face $5.3 billion in extra unemployment insurance payroll taxes from 2023 to 2027 compared with the baseline in 2020, according to the Common Sense Institute, a research group funded by the Chamber. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.